Well, now, in order to think of David as David the Valiant, brethren and sisters, first of all, we shall need to think of him as a young man. We shall need to think of his childhood, for this reason, that very often what men become eventually is related essentially to how they've been brought up. There's an old saying, you'll know, that the boy is father to the man. Of course, it's not always true, but sometimes it is, and I think it seems to be true in the case of David, how he was brought up. His early youth, when he was a boy, had a very marked effect upon him when he became a man. As you know, he was born in the town of Bethlehem. That means the house of bread. About the year 1040 BC, it was just about the time that King Saul was enthroned as the king of Israel. His father Jesse was a fairly prosperous farmer and was one of the elders of the town. Jesse had altogether 8 sons and, as far as we know, 2 daughters. Jesse had been married twice, and so had David's mother been married twice. And if you're saying, well, how does he know that? Well, if you want to find out, you'll have to compare 1 Chronicles 2:13 onwards. Not now, because it'll take you too long, but it's 1 Chronicles 2:13 onwards and 2 Samuel 17 verse 25. Jesse had been married twice, and so had David's mother been married twice. And when she married Jesse, she already had 2 daughters by her previous husband, and those daughters may have been the eldest members of the whole family. And about the time that David was born, those daughters had children of their own. So David was born to Jesse late in life, and when David was growing up, Jesse was an old man. So let's try to think of the situation then. 6 brothers and 2 stepsisters, all much older than David. His 3 elder brothers were all soldiers, and the eldest, Eliab, was probably a sergeant major. At least he sounds like it to me. Well, you can see that David was the kid brother. One gets a strong impression that David was, as a result of his family life, a loner. His father was old, his mother had her daughters and her grandchildren. His brothers were older than he was by a good part. They regarded him as a young upstart. The words of Eliab, which we've heard today in 1 Samuel 17, the sneering, rebuking words, "Why comest thou down thither, and with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart." As a modern translation puts it, "I know thy cheek and thy self-will." And then again, when at the request of Samuel, Jesse was urged to bring all his sons to the sacrifice, the feast, you remember that David was left out. This is 1 Samuel 16. David was left out. Now, either he was regarded as a nobody, not worth bothering with, or else Jesse felt that if he did come, it would only cause a lot of trouble with the others. And reading between the lines, it seems to me that David's home life was a disturbed one. It had not that cohesive love in it which makes for true family life. So, as a consequence, I propose to you, he was a loner. His job was to tend the flock of sheep, as you know, and so he, as a result of that, came to grips with loneliness and with opposition. His family life and his work developed in him the need to be a fighter and a shepherd. Now, he was a clever boy, there's no doubt of that. He was quick to learn, resourceful and sagacious. And I draw attention to the fact that life at this stage made him to be a fighter and a shepherd for a very special reason. And the reason is this: these are essentially the qualities of true kingship. This was the chief reason why Saul failed as a king. He was a warrior, but he had no shepherd qualities. as we said yesterday, Saul's concern was with frontiers and enemies and himself, and there's nothing wrong with that in itself, but he had no care for the people of God. He lacked the shepherd heart. Now, I do not know whether it is all right. I ought to have asked our brother president this, but I forgot. I don't know whether it's all right to quote Homer in a Christadelphian address, but it was Homer who said, "All true kings are shepherds." And the biblical revelation of true kingship is utterly in harmony with that. We shall see these two qualities being made incarnate in the life of David. The will to fight and a master passion of care for his people. Now you see, when you think about it, God was in this. This is the divine winepress. Samuel's words to King Saul when he was rejected, it's 1 Samuel 13 verse 14, "The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people." The words of Samuel. Just think of those words, "after his own heart." And then remember the psalm which David wrote, probably as he cared for the sheep in the wilderness and pondered his own loneliness. Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." The shepherd boy said, "The Lord is my shepherd." "After his own heart," said Samuel. The shepherd king of all men was being was preparing a man to be his shepherd, and he was preparing him for his high destiny. And what he was inwardly, therefore, is being made outward. And in the wilderness, as a consequence, he learned courage and cunning and patience and gentleness. He saw the invisible in a way. He heard the inaudible in the wilderness. And God commanded him, says Samuel, to be captain. Of course, David didn't realize it then. He hadn't heard it then. But he would eventually, and he was being made ready. And so the fighter, the shepherd, the psalmist, the king is being prepared by God. In loneliness, in danger, in opposition, in reflection, in skillfulness, with God in the wilderness. No wonder he is called David, the chosen of Yahweh. When you think of him as a young man then, how do you picture him? This is what I want to come to. Have you formed an impression in your mind about... How does he come into your mind as a young man? You see, I remember years ago, one of my brethren at Oxford giving some addresses on David, and he said that too often when we think of David as a young man, we tend to think of him as a lad, a rather short lad in a slight build, in shorts. That was nice. A lad in shorts, coming up to about the kneecaps of Goliath. And the implication was that this is quite wrong. First of all, when he was anointed king by Samuel secretly, he would have been about 18 years of age. And when he slew Goliath, he would have been about 20. And he must have been a very tough young man, physically. Because you do not kill a mountain lion and a bear unless you are strong. Now doubtless he killed them, or struck them, as he said, first of all with a stone and hitting them in the right place. David's words are, I smote him. But then the beast was not fully dead, and he rose up against David, and he caught it by the beard, as we've read, and he slew it finally. Now, in order to do that, brothers and sisters, you need to be very strong. And then again, when David was preparing to meet Goliath, you'll remember, King Saul offered him his own armour as a protection. He offered it to this young man. It's in 1 Samuel 17. We read it. Now, you remember that Saul was renowned for his height and his physical dimensions. And although later, afterwards, Saul did admit that he was foolish, he wasn't as foolish as to offer to David an armour which was quite evidently far too big for him. He wouldn't have been as foolish as that. He offered it to him, obviously, or it seems to be in the intention, it would have been useful, it would have protected him. And indeed David's reasons for not using it wasn't that it's far too big, sir, it was that I haven't proved it. And so the record in 1 Samuel 16 gives a description of David at this time, and this is how it goes. It's 1 Samuel 16 verse 18. It says he was cunning in playing and a mighty valiant man, a man of war, prudent in matter and a comely person, and the Lord is with him. And the record also says in verse 12 of the very same chapter, now he was ruddy and withal of a beautiful countenance and goodly to look at. Brother Harry Tennant, in his book on David, describes him like this: keen of eye, lithe of body, auburn haired, and of fair complexion. So you can see we have a well built young man, strong, tough and handsome. And when he stood before Saul, possibly to the discomfiture of Jesse and the anger of his brothers, God said to Samuel, this is he, anoint him. So let us pause for a moment just to learn an old lesson, to relearn it. I know you've heard it before, but it's worth hearing again, because we have the greatest difficulty in believing it. God's words to Samuel, explaining why he's chosen this David, it's in 1 Samuel 16 verse 7, the Lord seeth not as man seeth, for man looketh on the outward expression or appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart. A common, well-known lesson amongst us, but we have the greatest difficulty in believing it. The Lord looketh on the heart. So because he was a man after God's own heart, he was anointed king. Now let's come to this dramatic confrontation with Goliath about which we read. I don't propose to go through it in the narrative again, because you know it well. If it seems strange, brethren and sisters, that such an unlikely person is allowed to take on this giant, I mean, first of all, David, an unmilitary man, it fits ill with Samuel's military pride to allow this unmilitary man to take on Goliath. And then add to that a shepherd, a man who's not a soldier and a man who's a shepherd. Nevertheless, Saul allows him to act on behalf of Israel against this giant. And it's a measure, first of all, of Israel's desperation on the one hand, but also I think it's a measure of David's capacity to inspire confidence on the other. To some extent, it was a slumbering capacity, of course, at this time, but later on it will be developed and extended as the wine press works. It's very interesting, I think, that Saul and the company were willing to accept David's offer. Now, you know what happened? David chose 5 stones from the brook. It fascinates me a little bit. I don't know whether it does you. I've often wondered, why did he choose 5 stones? Remember, Goliath was covered in armour, and so I wonder whether he chose 5 stones as an estimate of what he would require to master the giant. Presumably that was it. And I wondered whether it represents a master plan, in a sense. 1 stone for the right eye, 1 stone for the left eye, and the others for the chinks in his armour, which David had measured. You see, he'd never seen a giant before. He'd smitten a lion, a bear in the wilderness, of course, but he'd done it with stones out of his sling. He must have been a superb marksman, mustn't he? As he bent down there by the brook, I can imagine his nimble brain probably going over the contest with the speed of a computer. He was working out exactly what had to be done. He was an astute young man, and he knew that he was good. But he didn't know whether he was good enough He didn't know whether the weapons he had would be sufficient against the giant. He killed a bear, but after all, a giant is different. So he placed his task in the hands of God. He said to Goliath, "I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand." Now, when you think about it, that's a very bold thing to say. He was saying, in effect, "Lord, this is your business. This is your contest. If I succeed, it will be your triumph. But if I fail, it will be your failure." That's what he's saying. It's a very bold prayer indeed. It's faith, but it's also true humility. See, there is a kind of humility, you will have met this already, I expect. There's a kind of mock humility which says, "I am no good," when you know very well you are very good. You've met that? Oh, goodness, yes. People are always saying, "I'm no good." Let me give you an illustration. Supposing you're doing some work in the truth, and somebody comes to you, it may be writing or speaking or pastoral work, and somebody comes to you and says, "That was very good. It's very commendable. It was excellent." And in your humility, you say, "Oh, no, no. Nothing at all. Nothing isn't worth mentioning." But if somebody else comes to you and says, "Well, that wasn't very good. It isn't worth mentioning," you take umbrage. I mean, if they tend to agree with your own estimate of what you're like, you don't like it. Now, that's the kind of humility I mean, you know. When you know you're quite good, as David did, but you say, "Oh no, I'm no good." Wasn't that sort of humility? He knew he was good. He did, because he was good. One is false humility, and the other is true humility. David came with what he had. What he had was essential. He came with it, his skill, his courage, his faith, and such as he had, he placed it at the disposal of God. He said, in effect, "Lord, I am come. It is your battle. If it fails, it will be your failure. Succor and save thy people." So it was a very bold and truly humble approach to God. It shows us that trusting and trying are not contradictory, they are complementary. Now, you know, the first stone killed the giant. To me, that's God's answer to David's faith. The very first stone did the necessary. Somebody has said that the stone must have been travelling at 200 feet a second. Now, I don't know whether that's right. Some of you perhaps, some of you will know whether that's whether that compares with a bullet from a gun. Perhaps you'll be able to tell us eventually. Anyway, the whole thing was over in a flash. The giant's head was hacked off, and the enemies of the Lord were devastated. And as the sun went down, the shepherd boy suddenly was the hero of the camp. Brother Harry Tennant makes a very nice point in his book about this. He says, if the giants had been dealt with properly when the Israelites occupied that portion of Anak in the days of Joshua, there would have been no giants to oppose Israel in the days of David. But in Gath, there was a pocket of them left. I don't know what the right term is for a gaggle of giants, but Harry called them a pocket. And so he says, makes a nice point, the giants of our past often make havoc of the present, and I think that's true. Psalm 144 is often regarded as David's song of thanks to God for his victory over Goliath. "Blessed be the Lord, my strength, which teacheth my hands to war and my fingers to fight." And so this day, brothers and sisters, think of it, this day, the turning point in the life of David, and indeed in the life of Israel, the shepherd boy has suddenly become a man of blood. Suddenly the loner is in the throb and sob of national life, a warrior, a hero, acclaimed and marvelled at. The youth has become a man, secretly anointed to be king in Israel while the first king is still alive. That was a very dangerous situation when that king happens to be Saul, the son of Kish. Let us pass on now. The long conflict with Saul is well known to you already. I don't propose to go through it in detail. The, For reasons of jealousy and fear and folly and selfishness, Saul hated David. He hounded him and hunted him like an animal. The feeling, in a way, is focused in what might appear to be a very superficial thing, which we've thought on already in this series, the number one song in Israel. A very superficial thing on the face of it, but in a way, it focuses fundamentally on the issues. You know, it went like this: Saul hath slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. And would I be wrong to suggest that this David, remembering what we said he was like, think what we said he's like, and he's a hero, would I be wrong to suggest that this David was the love of all the young women of Israel? Later on, the Philistines are going to refer to David when they speak to Achish. That's in 1 Samuel 21 verse 11. And they will say, "Is not this David king of the land? And did they not sing one to another of him in dances, saying, Saul hath slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands?" You see how remarkable that thing had become. It was known abroad that this is what happened. So it looks as though it focused very sharply this animosity between Saul and David. And his name became a legend in Israel, and yet he lives the life of an outcast and a vagabond. It's a very strange situation. If anybody harboured him, for example, they put their life at risk. Anointed by God to be king, and yet he's living like a displaced person. It's a very strange situation, isn't it? It seems that the very grace and loyalty of David awakened in Saul the rage of jealousy more and more. And Saul persistently persecuted David, and David reluctantly defended himself. Now, there's one thing I want to recall, because it will recur in a different context. Saul tried to bring about David's death, as you know, by asking as a kind of dowry for his daughter Michal the slaying of 100 Philistines, hoping that in the carrying out of this task David would be killed by the enemy. Well, the plan failed, and David killed not 100 Philistines but 200, and got Michal for his wife and became Saul's son-in-law. And you'll recall how David gathered about him 400 disaffected supporters and welded them into a fighting force. His whole family, no doubt, joined him in fear, I expect, from the persecution of Saul. There were the now two famous occasions when David could have ended the feud once and for all. The two occasions when he could have killed Saul with one blow, once in the cave at En-Gedi and the other on the hill at Hakilah. And herein is a master revelation of the mind of David. He would not touch the Lord's anointed. Firstly, no doubt this was due to the fact that it was utterly wrong. To touch the Lord's anointed meant challenging God. But it went deeper than that, no doubt. It seems as though David recognized that since God had anointed him to be king, God would direct the way in which it was to be achieved. And it's a mark of David's patience, I think, a mark of that strange capacity to wait on God's will. You see, think what strength really is. I mean, a really strong man is not a man who uses his strength when he has opportunity, but who, having the strength and the opportunity, restrains himself. That's a really strong man. And the capacity to wait on God is to be discovered in David. This is seen, of course, supremely in our Lord Jesus Christ himself. It's written of him. He went down to Nazareth and was subject to them, his parents. And that meant 18 years of waiting after he had been anointed by God, recognized in the words, "Wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business?" 18 years of dedicated, commonplace life at Nazareth. 18 years of submission to the authority of his parents in order at last to be ready to wield authority. 18 years of ordinary life, faithfully lived, waiting for the moment divinely arranged. And so it was with David, the waiting and the restraint and the provocation, moulding the character of David, come pressing him in the winepress of God. And so he poured out his soul in psalm after psalm, as you know, and his dreams and his hopes and his fears were inscribed for everyone to ponder down the ages. There are one or two things to note at this stage. Just retracing our steps for a moment, observe David's concern for his own parents. Now, the record, if you want, it's 1 Samuel 22, verse 3. It says, "And David went thence to Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, Let my father and mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me." Doubtless he sought the safety of Moab. He felt a certain sense of security in Moab because of his own descent from Ruth the Moabitess. And David made the journey of some 50 miles to beseech the king of Moab for refuge for his old father and mother. And the command of God was reverence. In the midst of all his troubles and all his difficulties and all his hardship and all his isolation, his reverence for the law of God is to be seen. Honour thy father and mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. And let it be said to the credit of the king of Moab that he received and succoured David's parents all the days that David was an outcast. Now think of something else. What we have to do, you see, in order to try to form an assessment of David's character, we have to look at certain things that happened to him and see how he behaves. Now, the next is the case of Nabal. The record's in 1 Samuel 25. You know the story well. Nabal was a rich farmer. David had given him protection, and David and his men felt that they were entitled to some recompense. On this occasion they were hungry and were looking for some reward for their services, and David approached Nabal asking for this reward, this recompense. Well, you know the story. Nabal, mean and surly, refused point blank, and not only refused point blank but insulted the messenger, deriding this David. And David suddenly mobilized his forces. His heart was filled with cold-blooded murder. He would show Nabal just who David was. And in a way, Nabal had signed his own death warrant when he rejected David's request. Pause to reflect, what a strange thing life can be. I mean, David had received injury after injury from Saul, and his only reply was to forgive him. One injury from Nabal and he's out with cold steel ready to do murder. It just shows you how complex human nature is. Reverence and irreverence in the same life, mixed up together in the same heart. What a strange thing human nature is. What an accumulation of complexity it is. There is an explanation, no doubt, and you may like to discuss this when we come to that time. But think next of Abigail, Nabal's young and beautiful wife. She met David deliberately and dissuaded him from his willfulness. It was a very timely intervention, for had David gone ahead, had he gone on with his bitter plan, it might well have resulted in untold consequences. Sometimes, you see, bad men have good wives, sometimes. And so it was with Nabal. Abigail knew of David, although Nabal seems not to. She was a woman of grace and understanding. She spoke words of faith to David. I'd like you to have a look at them with me, because I think we ought to mark them very well. It's in 1 Samuel 25, verses 27 to 31. The words of Abigail to David, a very enlightening passage. She said, 1 Samuel 25, 27, "And now this blessing which thine handmaid hath brought unto my Lord, let it even be given unto the young men that follow my Lord. I pray thee forgive the trespass of thine handmaid, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord fighteth the battles of the Lord, and evil hath not been found in thee all thy days. Yet a man is risen to pursue thee and to seek thy soul, but the soul of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of life with the Lord thy God, and the souls of thine enemies, them shall he sling out and out of the middle of a sling. And it shall come to pass, when the Lord shall have done to my Lord according to all the good that he hath spoken concerning thee, and shall have appointed thee ruler over Israel, that this shall be no grief unto thee, nor offence of heart unto my Lord, either that thou hast shed blood causeless of that my Lord hath avenged himself. And but when the Lord shall have dealt with my Lord, then remember thine handmaid. A very remarkable declaration by Abigail. Evidently it's very strong allusions to the life of David, and at times seems almost to be divinely prophetic in its spiritual sense. And so David, mad with anger, consumed with the desire for revenge, was restrained by these words of this faithful and prudent woman, Abigail. And in the words which follow in the narrative, if we went on in the narrative, David recognizes this, and he recognizes that she was God sent in order to save him from his folly. 10 days after this, Nabal was dead. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. Men are not entitled to usurp the judgment of God. And this, in a way, is the parable of the rich fool all over again. Now, after Nabal's death, David asked for the hand of Abigail in marriage. And so she left her rich, secure home to become the wife of a man with no home and no security and no comfort. I mean, it's a love story, isn't it? Evidently they were in love. It's a very charming story, as Brother Harry Tennant puts it, quoting from the Prince of Poets, "A Marriage of True Minds." Now verse 42 of 1 Samuel 25 says, "And Abigail hasted and arose and went after the messengers of David, and she became his wife." I want you to have a look at verse 43 of the same chapter. It goes like this: "And David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they were also both of them his wives." Now that's very interesting. He's just married a beautiful woman with whom he's in love, and within 5 minutes he's married another beautiful woman. David so quickly took another wife after marrying this faithful, lovely, loving Abigail. No word of reproof comes from God. And if we're seeking to understand this man David, we must take notice of this and leave it for the moment, because we shall have to return to it ere this series is over. Now here is something to ponder as we think of the character of David. Remember when we were speaking yesterday of King Saul, and we recalled that awful episode at Nob, when David came seeking help and sustenance and took the sacred showbread and secured the sword of Goliath for his warfare. Now in order to get this benefit, he told a lie to the priest Ahimelech. He said he was on some urgent and secret business of the king, and he urged Ahimelech to give way to him. And the priest, upon that understanding of the situation, he did give way. And as a result of David's action, as you know, all the priests save one, and all the women and children and babies in Nob, innocent people, were slain. And when the one priest, Abiathar, escaped and fled, he came and told David what had occurred. And this is David's reply. It's in 1 Samuel 22:22. "And David said unto Abiathar, I knew it that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of my father's house." Now you try to imagine, brethren and sisters, the burden of that upon this man David. He is a sensitive man, say what you will. He is a sensitive man. He is not like Saul. He's a man whose soul is who agonizes over things that other men would dismiss. And he saved himself and caused, in the doing of it, caused the death of so many others who were quite innocent. Think of the burden of that upon his heart. And think of this again. Twice David sought refuge in the presence of the very people who were the sworn enemies of his own people, the people of Gath. I'm trying to draw your attention to the complexity of human nature. You will recall the first occasion. He feigned madness and scrabbled on the doors of the gate. He let his spittle fall down upon his beard. He was a resourceful man. That means he was quick to respond to the demand of the circumstances in which he was. In modern language, they would say he was a pragmatist. So he feigned madness, but it was not very successful. Either he wasn't a very good actor, or they were very quick to understand the situation. It failed, and he left. It's the second time that he sought refuge in Gath, to which I want to direct your attention now. It's in 1 Samuel 27. You just notice how the chapter begins. And David said in his heart, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. When I made my notes, I noticed that in my Bible, at the head of the chapter, it says, David's lapse of faith, he goes to the Philistines. Now, there were 600 men with him, and also his two wives, Ahinoam and Abigail. David prevailed upon Achish, the king of Gath, to give him a town to occupy and live in. And the town he got was called Ziklag on the border. Now, what a strange thing it is. Here is David, well established in the midst of the very country he had been kicked out of when he feigned madness, in among the very people whose champion he had slain. And what did he do when he was living at Ziklag? Did he rest and take stock of the situation? Not a bit. Because it says every day with his 600 trained men he went forth raiding the countryside, ransacking the villages, attacking the people, killing everybody, man, woman and child. Not one survivor is allowed in any raid. Everybody's throat was slit. And they took all the booty and the livestock they could find and brought it back to Ziklag. But that's not all of it. When Achish came to see him from time to time, it almost makes you smile in a way. Achish remarked upon all the booty that David had accumulated and said, "Where did you get it?" And David said, well, you ought to notice David's reply. He said, oh, I got it from those Israelites I hate so much. I raid Judah, you know, and the Jerahmeelites and the Kenites and Achish. He comes out as a rather simple-minded man to me. Achish believed him and thought how good it was that David was fighting his own people. And it went on for 16 months, and nobody ever found out, because there were nobody was left alive to testify. There were no witnesses. The witnesses were liquidated. Nobody ever split. Everybody who might have split, their voices had gone. And then when the Philistines mobilized their forces to fight King Saul, Achish, king of Gath, took David along with him as his personal bodyguard. I love this, don't you? I mean, is there anything more ridiculous when you think about it? What David was thinking about, what must have been in his mind when he was appointed the personal bodyguard of the king of Gath to fight against his own people? What a strange situation. In a way, this story could well have been, well, it's so fantastic, it could well have been prepared for the Arabian Nights. When David returned to his families at Ziklag, he found, this is a nice touch too, when he returned to his families after going out into the battle, when he returned to his families at Ziklag, he found that they had been raided by the Amalekites. You know, it's like a burglar having a burglar in his own house. And the Amalekites had come and raided David's possessions at Ziklag. But this was the difference. Nobody's throat had been slit. Nobody had been injured, just taken prisoner. David and his men pursued the Amalekites, beat them in the desert, and got back their wives and their children safe and sound. Nobody was hurt. Nobody was lost. What a strange story it is, isn't it? It reveals another aspect of the character of David. One writer has said it's a story of murder and treachery and lying. I only draw your attention to it, my comrades, to impress upon you how complex human nature can be. In the same heart, in the heart of a man whose heart is fashioned after God's heart, in a man so good, such a strange thing. Now, you might like to discuss it when we come to it, to see how you are able to approve it or disapprove it or what you think. But what you will have to think about is this: whether it was right or wrong, this was the David who loved his sheep, who cared for his people, and who would not lift his hand to hurt his worst enemy. The same man, essentially. This is the fascination of seeing human nature from different directions. We must now come to the last days of Saul. Remember, we thought about it to some extent yesterday. The situation in Israel was now desperate. There were no priests for Saul to seek to, for they had been slain by him. As we remembered yesterday, in defiance of his own edict, he sought commerce with the underworld of Evil. To me it appears that God used Saul's way of seeking an answer to give him an answer. Yesterday we made that point. He heard his own doom from the lips of Samuel. A major battle with the Philistines was upon him. It was in the valley of Jezreel. The Israelites were driven back to the mountain of Gilboa. They were routed, and Saul and his son Jonathan were slain. The awful news of this came to David when he was in Ziklag. David and his men wept at the news of the death of the king and his son. It is sometimes in the presence of solemn drama and tragedy that men are seen most clearly. The shams then are shed. The masks are off. Men are exposed as they really are. Window dressing is finished. And when you have time, read again David's lamentation. It's in 2 Samuel 1 verses 17 to 27. There isn't time now, but read it again. It's one of the most gracious things in the whole of the Bible. Here are a few sentences. David, when he had news of the death of Saul and Jonathan, he said, "The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy places. How are the mighty fallen? Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished." And remembering all the things he had suffered at the hands of Saul, what a generous man this David is. He is ready to leave all the judgment in the hands of God. Now, as a result of the death of Saul, the way was now ready for David to become the king of Israel. And that, my comrades, is the business of the next address.